From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Guy Raz. This episode, the politics of gay marriage.
Marriage is a relationship between one man and one woman.
And how this may have changed America.
Well, what do you think? Too gay?
Yeah, definitely. But the shirt's good.
How TV may be changing public attitudes about gay marriage. Also, two new stories from our three-minute fiction contest, The 12 Days of Disaster That Gave Birth to Modern Chicago, and the day in 1977 when the unknown Arturo Sandoval showed Dizzy Gillespie around Havana.
And finally, I saw my man. I said to myself, I said, oh my goodness, and now what am I going to do? I cannot say a word in English.
Plus, the king of late night like you've never seen him.
Tonight's a monologue is is dedicated to President Nixon. I've got a monologue that just won't quit.
The private life of Johnny Carson. That's all in this episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. For 3 days now, Mitt Romney's campaign has tried to steer the national conversation back to the economy. But the pressure to respond to President Obama's announcement in support of gay marriage has been intense. And this morning, at a speech to students at Liberty University in Lynchburg, Virginia, Romney definitively spoke out.
Marriage is a relationship between one man and one woman.
We'll have more on that speech in a few moments, but first to our cover story, Gay Marriage, Politics, and an American Social Revolution. The day after North Carolina became the 30th state to pass a constitutional ban on same-sex marriage this week, Tyler Curtin, a professor at the University of North Carolina, wrote an open letter about his predicament.
Last night, I talked with my husband of 12 years about what we should do. I love UNC. I love its students, but it is clear that a majority of its voters will carve in large, bloody letters hatred into its constitution.
We spoke with Tyler Curtin this week about North Carolina, about his future there, and about his partner, Jay.
Oh, I can't even tell you how much I love Jay. Words don't describe.
His partner is a physician. Tyler Curtin teaches English at UNC.
We met by chance, and we had a first date in a coffee shop. You know, towards the end of that day, he looked at me and he said, I think we're going to have a second date. And I said, oh? And he said, yeah. And I said, okay. And then it became a third date. Then a year later, I was talking with a friend of mine and I said, I think I have a boyfriend. I think I have a partner. And it just blossomed. It was unexpected and it was delightful.
The two men had always planned to stay in North Carolina forever. But now, Tyler Curtin and his husband, Jay, are having second thoughts.
I was talking with them, and I thought, oh, they want to make us strangers. You know, we care for each other, but they want to make sure that if you were ill, I couldn't see you in the hospital. Or that if I were to die, that the house that we live in together, that should some relative of mine contest it, that you would not be able to inherit.
Tyler Curtin has now begun the process of looking for a tenured position elsewhere, maybe Massachusetts, maybe New York.
The people of North Carolina, I don't think they know exactly what they've done.
That sentiment was shared by the state's governor, Bev Perdue, a Democrat, who opposed the move to change the state's constitution.
Folks are saying, what in the world is going on in North Carolina? We look like Mississippi.
A Gallup poll released this past week shows slightly more than half of Americans agree with President Obama on the gay marriage issue. But a sizable number of Americans don't, including Tammy Fitzgerald, who runs the North Carolina Values Coalition and helped spearhead that state's move to have marriage defined as a union between a man and a woman.
I do think the vote in North Carolina is representative of the country. I mean, we won this by 61% of the vote, and it was a 22-point margin. That's a pretty resounding win, and I think it reflects to a large extent the mood of the country. I think there's a lot of wishful thinking out there that the mood of the country is changing, but I personally don't believe that it is.
I asked Tammy Fitzgerald to explain how gay marriage would threaten the institution of marriage.
The threat to couples that have traditional marriages, so to speak, is not so much a threat to their marriage as a threat to their freedoms. And what we've seen in other states has happened, where gay marriage has become a legalized institution of the state, is that this higher right, this so-called special right of same-sex couples to get married then somehow trumps the rights of other citizens in the state to carry on their lives and their business as they see fit. For instance, in the state of Vermont, there are bed and breakfast owners who have been sued because they didn't want to offer their bed and breakfast, which usually is their home, as a venue for a same-sex wedding. In New Mexico, a photographer was fined by the state for refusing to provide her services as a photographer for a same-sex wedding in the state of Massachusetts. That's the danger.
Tammy Fitzgerald with the North Carolina Values Coalition. Patrick Wooden Sr. is a pastor at the predominantly African-American Upper Room Church of God in Christ in Raleigh, North Carolina. He also opposes gay marriage, and he also helped to organize the grassroots campaign in that state.
I was extremely disappointed in what the president did in making this announcement that he supports same-sex marriage and to portray it as though it was some type of metamorphosis or evolution that he went through. You know, it sounds like another politician who said, I voted against it before I voted for it, and now I'm against it.
Now that the president has come out in support of this, as you know, the vast majority of African Americans backed him in 2008.
Right.
Probably most of your congregants supported him.
Yes, a great number of them.
Do you believe that this will have any impact at all on his support from African Americans?
I hope that it does. I hope that the African-American community vote their religion and their religious doctrines above their pride. It was a proud moment to see a man of African-American descent occupy the White House, and many African-Americans were moved by that. But the same man now has taken a position that is totally antithetical to Christian teaching. So I'm hoping that the African-American community will pay more attention to their Christian doctrine than what any politician may or may not say, whether they're Democrat, Republican, or independent.
Patrick Wooden, he's the senior pastor at the Upper Room Church of God in Christ in Raleigh. Well, what about the national politics of all of this? All this week, Mitt Romney did everything he could to avoid talking about gay marriage. He did address it in a speech at Liberty University today, but the president's position may now force Romney to draw a clear contrast when it comes to all gay issues. Rich Taffel is the founder of the Log Cabin Republicans. That's a gay Republican group, and he says Romney's position on gay issues has shifted over the years.
Certainly when he was running for Senate in Massachusetts in 1994, he really made a case to Log Cabin Republicans at that time that he would be even better than Senator Kennedy because he'd be a moderate Republican that supported gay rights. He basically made the pitch, look, I'm a business guy. I've never discriminated against gay people. I have no problem with it. And I'd be a supporter if I was in the Senate.
And that was a genuine view. I mean, he wasn't just saying that he believed that.
That's the question, I think. I believe that he believed that at the time. And having met with him at the time, it seemed like he had no problem with it at all.
When he eventually, of course, he lost that race against Ted Kennedy. Mm-hmm. When he eventually did become governor of Massachusetts, how do you assess his position on gay issues?
Nothing dramatic changed from former Republican governors who were very supportive on gay rights.
Like Bill Weld.
Bill Weld, Jane Swift, Paul Cellucci. So there was a history there, and he pretty much maintained that history. When the issue of marriage came up, and it was historic in Massachusetts.
This was in 2004, of
exactly,
course.
Yeah. There was a pivot that took place in his administration where it wasn't just, boy, I'm uncomfortable with this, I don't support it. It was really almost a launch of a presidential campaign. It felt very odd at the time that he would really ride this issue as a governor when there were so many other issues for the state. And so it felt to many there was a bit of a pivot, and he was saying, I've got no future in Republican politics unless I pivot on this issue and show to the conservatives I'm anti-gay.
How did people in that state react? Because, of course, Massachusetts is one of the traditionally most liberal states in the country. Did folks in Massachusetts, were they irritated by it? Or did they wonder why he was focused on it? Did they support him?
I think they were irritated by it, and he decided not to run for another term of governor, so that might sum it up.
Now that this issue of gay marriage has really come to the forefront with President Obama's, first of all, let me ask you for your reaction of President Obama's statement. How did you feel when you heard the president say, I support marriage equality?
I was very excited by it. I'm very moved by it. I know there's a lot of political calculation right now, but I kind of saw it in the sweep of history, and I saw it as a very historic moment for a president taking a lead on civil rights issues.
Do you think it backs Mitt Romney into a corner?
I think it does box him in. He is really a moderate. That's what's hurt him in the primary.
He is truly a moderate. He's not, as he has said, severely conservative.
Yeah, he's not severely conservative, but he's a pragmatic businessman who will do what it takes to win. Mm. And he will run an amazing campaign, and I think people underestimate his abilities. That said, personally, I think he supports civil rights. He comes from an ancestry of his father was a champion on civil rights for African Americans. So this is where he's coming from. I think the Republican Party, where it stands today, for a moderate from Massachusetts who's Mormon to win the primary, he has to really kowtow to the social conservative wing of the party. And I think that's what's boxed him in, because he can't win in swing states as a social conservative.
You have written a lot about Romney and his position on gay issues. What happens if he doesn't, if he doesn't show more support for gay rights?
I think he's going to have to reach out to the swing states in the middle and support gay rights. He has to demonstrate it in a number of ways, including his vice presidential choice. But he's going to have to find a way to say, gay marriage might be too far for me, but look at this is who I am. And he's going to have to get right up to the president, because I think on a lot of these swing states, swing voters, independent voters, are looking at those issues. The economy will obviously dominate this election, but they're also looking for authenticity, and that's been a challenge for Mitt Romney. And I think this marriage issue to date has been a hurt for President Obama, and I think he changed that by coming out in favor of it.
Now that the president of the United States has come out in support of marriage equality, do you believe that the momentum is now so powerful that there's no turning back?
Yes, I believe that the momentum on gay marriage is inevitable. Someday we'll look at people who oppose gay marriage the way we do of people who fought against liberating slaves. It'll be that kind of issue. We'll be embarrassed. No one will brag, and their grandchildren will brag about the fact they were opposed to gay marriage. And if you're already speaking to young people under 30, it's almost beyond their imagination that this is an issue. So it really is a generational issue. A younger president has declared himself in favor of it. That's why I do believe it's a very historic moment, and we'll look back to it and appreciate it for the history that he created by doing it.
That's Rich Tafel. He's the founder of the Log Cabin Republicans, a gay Republican group. In a moment, we'll explore how TV shows like Will and Grace and even Modern Family have started to change the way Americans think about gay couples. Stay with us. You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
You move me, Kurt. And this duet would just be an excuse to spend more time with you.
This is a clip from the hugely popular TV show Glee. It's about a high school glee club. And in that scene, Blaine, who's played by Darren Criss, declares his love for Kurt, who's played by Chris Colfer. Now, what you didn't hear was their kiss, which became one of the most talked about moments of that season. And Glee is just one of many shows on TV right now that feature gay characters. And Edward Schiappa, a professor of communication studies at the University of Minnesota, has been looking into this. For the past decade, he's been studying the correlation between more gay characters on TV and public attitudes about gays and lesbians.
Really, with the emergence of the extraordinarily popular Will and Grace show, more and more Americans, sort of from the safety of their armchair, could learn a bit about gay people who they might not otherwise have learned from real life.
That was a turning point, Will and Grace, you say, even though there were gay characters on television before Will and Grace premiered in 1998, but that was a turning point.
I think there was a turning point simply because of two factors. One is it was enormously popular. So the popularity of that show and the fact that there were two major gay male characters in the show who were very different allowed the show to do what I call important category work. And what I mean by that is, you know, there were some critics who said, well, Will isn't gay enough and Jack's too gay. Well, actually, that's great, because you learn that there's diversity within that category that you had in your head before of gay men.
Will, what do you think? Too gay?
Yeah, definitely. But the shirt's good.
So viewers saw Will, and he was this kind of straight-laced attorney, and Jack was more sort of flamboyant. But, I mean, they were characters that were likable, and people could identify with them in some way, even if they weren't gay or they didn't know gay people.
Right. And what our research found was that a couple ingredients, if you will, can lead to attitude change. One of those ingredients is, which you just nailed, is, you know, are they likable or are they trustworthy? Are they attractive? There's research that says if they're attractive, it can influence your attitudes. The other part of the mix is, are you learning things through their behaviors and observing them that you didn't know about that category beforehand? If so, then the more complicated your category of whatever it is, lesbians, gay men, the less likely you are to reduce them down to a stereotype.
When Ellen DeGeneres came out on her show Ellen in 1997, and of course in real life, that was a big deal. I mean, that was a huge sort of television moment.
Why can't I say the word? I mean, why can't I just say I'm gay?
Yes, it was a big deal. It was a certainly symbolic breakthrough, but I think that there was a lot of other heavy lifting left to be done, which at least in part has been done.
Let me ask you about the show Modern Family. This is the most popular show in the United States today. Not only does it prominently feature a gay couple, but a gay couple that has a child and is in the process of adopting a second child.
Cam, what's the scribble on the Vanity Fair about an adoption agency?
Oh, yeah, they called to say they wanted to reschedule our home visit.
When? Why didn't you tell me that this is kind of important?
Well, when does it say?
Who knows? It disappears into Jennifer Aniston's hair. You gotta get a better system.
There is nothing wrong with my system. Ask me anything about any upcoming event and I can tell you when and where it is.
When is the adoption agency visit?
Okay, is that a five or a curl? Oh, I hope Jen's finally found love.
This is a show that's won awards from Catholic organizations. Mitt Romney has talked about Modern Family as a show that he really likes. It seems to attract wide appeal, and yet it does have a gay couple at its core.
The idea of there being a gay couple who have children is much more in the mainstream now than it certainly has been recognized at almost any time prior to that. So there's no question that that show is doing what I've described before as category work. It's changing our understanding of what gay men are like, and particularly as parents.
Now that we're increasingly seeing gay married couples on TV, not just in Modern Family, but also in Grey's Anatomy, this seems to be more and more of a trend. And apparently next season NBC will be introducing more programs that include gay married couples. What's your sense of how that is going to impact how the American public thinks about this issue?
Part of it, of course, is going to depend on how those portrayals are, because if they're not sympathetic or positively portrayed...
I mean, so far they have been.
That's right. So those portrayals, if they continue to be sympathetic, will only contribute to that larger sea change that we see across society, really, in terms of their attitudes towards gay marriage.
That's Professor Edward Chiappa. He heads the Communications Studies Department at the University of Minnesota, talking about the correlation between gay TV characters and public opinion. Professor Chiappa, thank you so much.
Thank you for inviting me.
Okay, we are very close to the end of round 8 of 3-Minute Fiction, where we ask you to write an original piece of fiction that can be read in about 3 minutes. Next weekend, our judge this round, the novelist Luis Alberto Urrea, will finally announce the winner. Now remember, this time the first sentence had to begin, she closed the book, placed it on the table, and finally decided to walk through the door. We received more than 6,000 stories this time. It's a record. So let's hear excerpts from two of them that our readers liked.
She took the ferry over to the island. In a snack bar no bigger than a bathroom stall, she bought 2 cellophane-wrapped tuna sandwiches on white bread and used them to cushion the revolver in her bag. The man at the opposite dock who opened the gate to allow the ferry passengers entry smiled in a familiar way, though she did not know him. Certain pale roses lining the path to the rocky beach also had a familiar look, as did the worn gray boardwalk and the color and tilt of 3 beach umbrellas, a red one sloping west, and the other 2, a green stripe and a solid blue, to the east. She walked between the red and the green stripe down to the shore, stepping over a curving line of seaweed stranded by the tide. A small silver button shone within the cage of its tendrils. For almost an hour, she walked east along the shore, the backsliding waves filling her footprints with foam and sometimes minute opalescent shells. She looked back 3 times. The 3 umbrellas diminished from colored shapes to dots and finally to points of indeterminate color and orientation. She knew she was approaching the next part.
That's NPR's Melissa Block reading an excerpt from the story Exercise by India DeCarmine of Babylon, New York. Here's another excerpt from a story our readers picked.
She feared their arrival, but found herself lost among the individual characteristics contained within the lifeless horde. Each member of the undead congregation seemed to retain features that told a little story about who they had been in life. There was a zombie dressed to play tennis. Another was a policeman in uniform. One was balding, but clearly favored a comb-over hairstyle. Another had beautiful, shiny, long black hair. The one with the lovely hair seemed to be smiling, a death grimace, really. She wondered what lay beyond that disturbing grin. Who had these zombies been? What had brought them to this disturbing place? Were they gone completely, or were they still inside their earthly containers, trapped by fate?
That's our Bob Mondello with Letting Go by Graham Sanders of Oregon City, Oregon. Thanks to all our listeners who submitted stories for this round. You can find the full versions of these two and more at our website, npr.org/3-Minute Fiction. That's 3-Minute Fiction, all spelled out, no spaces. And don't forget to tune in to Weekends and All Things Considered next weekend when our judge, Luis Alberto Urrea, reveals the winner of this round of 3-Minute Fiction. In 1919, Chicago was called the youngest great city in the world. The First World War had just ended, the troops were coming home, industry was booming, and crime in that city was way down. And yet, right in the thick of it, disaster, 12 days that shook that city right at the height of the summer of 1919. Gary Crist writes about it in his new book. It's called City of Scoundrels. And at the time, Chicago's mayor, William Hale Thompson, he was known as Big Bill Thompson, had just been reelected, and he was pushing an ambitious infrastructure project that would reshape the city forever.
He was this extremely colorful, extravagantly corrupt blowhard who always wore this cowboy hat. And he liked to think of himself as the people's David, defending the common Chicagoan against the Goliaths of wealth and privilege. But he really was a big champion of the Chicago Plan projects, which allowed for a lot of kickbacks and patronage, so it was understandable. But he called himself Big Bill the Builder, and he really embraced this project.
Widely regarded as the worst mayor in Chicago's history. Well, and somebody, by the way, reading the book, who reminded me of another Illinois politician who will not be named.
Right. He's very much in that tradition.
You get to the summer, anybody who's been in Chicago during the summer knows it is a hot place. We're talking about 1919, so no air conditioning.
It was a hot July. The soldiers were returning from Europe.
Looking for jobs.
A lot of the jobs had been taken by the influx of African-American workers who had come.
We're in the middle of the Great Migration.
At the beginning of the Great Migration. They had come up to fill these jobs during the wartime labor shortage. And so they're all converging on the city just when the economy was winding down from its wartime peak. So there was really intense competition for jobs, for social services, and especially for housing. All of these tensions were just coming to a head in July of 1919 when the city was hit by this bizarre series of mishaps.
It begins shortly before 5 p.m. on Monday, July 21st, 1919. What happens that day?
A Goodyear blimp was making an exhibition flight over the city. It mysteriously caught fire and crashed in the downtown loop. It came through the skylight right into the central courtyard of the Illinois Trust and Savings Bank. And it ended up killing a number of people inside. And
13 people, you write.
13 people. And it sort of set off a wave of hysteria in the city. People just thought, if you're not safe working in the middle of a bank, where are you safe?
So that happens, and it kind of dominoes into a series of unrelated but horrendous events that take place over the next 12 days. The next day, a couple from another part of Chicago arrived to a police station in the Gold Coast area, John Wilkinson and his wife. They're immigrants from Scotland. Their 6-year-old daughter is missing.
Yeah, she was on the street coming home from a park with her friends and said goodbye, and that was the last anybody ever saw of her. And for days, the whole city was consumed with the mystery of this disappearance. She was a very popular little girl. And when it turned out that it was a seemingly innocuous neighbor who was the culprit and that he had actually kidnapped and killed her and then buried her body in his own basement, that sort of set off another wave of hysteria about whether one's friends and neighbors could be trusted.
The headlines blared across the newspapers, right?
Oh, yeah. It was making the biggest headlines during the actual period.
The next day, July 27th, 1919, the most significant series of events breaks out in Chicago. Some young African-American boys are rafting along the lakefront. They drift toward a whites-only beach accidentally. Stones are thrown at them. Shots are fired. One of the boys is hit in the head and drowns, and thus begins a series of race riots, white mobs ransacking black neighborhoods in Chicago for days.
Right. It really just spiraled into a five-day orgy of violence that was really revolting in many ways. The police seemed incapable of doing anything about it. There were rumors that some of the white rioters were politically protected, and so the police weren't touching them. This was considered one of the first race riots in history where blacks really aggressively fought back. Hmm. And this was seen as a positive by many black leaders.
Talk about that resistance for a moment.
Well, there was this sense among the black community that black soldiers had performed in a stellar fashion in the war in Europe. And they had come back and they were ready to claim their rights as American citizens. And what do they get? They get race riots and abuse. So there was this rising, they called it the new Negro sensibility, this rising sense of pride and sense of entitlement to respect and to the basic rights that everyone else in the country was guaranteed. So that created a volatile background to the violence on the street.
It got to the point where Mayor Thompson, Big Bill Thompson, had to call in the National Guard.
Yes, he was reluctant to do this, but finally things got so bad that he blinked first and he said, even though I don't like going to the governor, I will write out this written request. And within hours, there were thousands of troopers heading into the streets with howitzers and rifles and bayonets, and they met a lot of resistance, but really within 24 hours, they had more or less restored order.
I'm speaking with Gary Crist. He's the author of a new book. It's called City of Scoundrels, The 12 Days of Disaster That Gave Birth to Modern Chicago. Gary, this period of 12 days also claimed many lives. How many people died, by the way?
38 period? People died. There were over 500 injured, and thousands were left homeless because there were a lot of fires at the end.
What kind of impact did this have on the history of racial politics in Chicago, which has been a difficult one, to say the least?
Yeah, certainly it did change race relations in the city for years to come. There was understandably a lot of bitterness after the riot, and it really had the effect of hardening the color line that had just really been developing in the city over the previous few years. So it really left a legacy of residential segregation in Chicago that lasted for decades, and some would say the legacy is still there.
What about the plan to redevelop Chicago? Whatever happened to it?
Interestingly enough, one of the effects of the crisis was Mayor Thompson came out stronger than ever. And since he was such a big champion of the Chicago plan, I think a lot more of the Chicago plan did get finished. And so a lot of the architectural gems that make Chicago such a showpiece today, you know, the Navy Pier, the Magnificent Mile, the Michigan Avenue Bridge, the park system, all of these were kind of a legacy of this mayor who is a joke in some circles.
That's writer Gary Crist. His new book is called City of Scoundrels. It's about the 12 days of disaster that gave birth to modern Chicago. The book is now out. Gary, thank you so much for coming in.
Happy to be here.
Dizzy Gillespie was an inspiration to generations of musicians, including our next guest, Cuban-born trumpeter Arturo Sandoval. Arturo Sandoval first met Dizzy Gillespie in Havana in 1977 when the American jazzman came to Cuba to play a concert. Sandoval showed him around the city where the two men listened to the sounds of rumba music echoing through Havana's black neighborhoods. That night, Arturo Sandoval managed to play his trumpet for Dizzy Gillespie, and the Cuban jazzman blew Dizzy away. It was the start of a friendship that lasted until Gillespie's death in 1993. Arturo Sandoval's latest record pays tribute to Dizzy Gillespie as a mentor and a friend. It's called Dear Diz, Every Day I Think of You. And Arturo Sandoval joins us now from our studios at NPR West. Welcome to the program. Great to have you.
Yes, hello, how are you? Thank you so much for having me here today.
Thank you indeed. First Havana that night in 1977. He didn't know you were a musician at all, right?
I was embarrassed to tell him I was a musician, you know. somebody called me. Let me tell you the whole story because it's very interesting. Somebody called me from the musician union. He called me, Arturo, I'm calling you because I know you're a big fan of Dizzy Gillespie. And he's going to come this afternoon to Havana. They was doing a jazz cruise through the Caribbean. I went to the harbor and I was waiting there. And finally, I saw my man coming downstairs. I said to myself, I said, oh my goodness, and now what am I going to do? I cannot say a word in English. At that time, I couldn't speak any English, zero, nothing, it was nothing. But I was so lucky because a guy walks behind him and started to talk to me in Spanish. It was a percussionist by the name of Ray Mantilla, and he was playing with Stanguettes. And he started to talk to me in Spanish, and he asked me, do you know this man? I said, of course, yes. I never met him in person, but I know who he is. And he said, are you a musician? I said, no. And then this is say right away, do you have a car? I said, yes, I have a little car. At that time, I have a Plymouth 1951. I just painted with a brush with tar and gasoline. It was my father helped me to do it. And that car looks horrible. And the passenger door doesn't open, and then he has to get through the driver door. And then he said, this car is horrible. This is a Russian car? I said, no, it's a Plymouth. And then he said, okay, show me in Havana. I never been here before. That was his very first visit to Cuba. You know, a lot of people, we thought he went there so many times before, but no, that was the very first. It was May 77.
And so you played for him that night. And what did he say? What did he think?
Oh, he was laughing because I knew a bunch of his lines, you know, his phrasing and things. And he was laughing and laughing and laughing because he was so surprised because he saw me as his driver, you know, the guy who was showing him the city. And not only was a musician, I was a trumpet player, you know. And the whole day we spent together, I felt embarrassed to tell him I was a trumpet player. I was so lucky because we became such a close friend, and he was my mentor of mine. He encouraged me so much. He gave me so many opportunities over the years. And actually, when I have the opportunity to came to live here forever, he was very crucial, instrumental in that move.
Talk about taking this music, the music of Dizzy Gillespie, and putting your stamp on it, rearranging it. How did you sort of think about how to do that and still, you know, pay tribute to him, but also showcase what you do?
It's 11 tunes. It's 10 of them, they're Dizzy composition. This only one I wrote is a ballad I wrote for him. The rest is his music. But the thing which is very particular in this record is the arrangement. I really think the arrangers and everybody put their effort and their 100% to really pay tribute to one of our biggest heroes in jazz.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with trumpeter Arturo Sandoval about his latest recording. It's called Dear Diz, and it's a tribute to Dizzy Gillespie. Arturo Sandoval, so much of Dizzy Gillespie's performance was human and fun-loving. It was uplifting. It was something you could feel, you know, even if you weren't familiar with the music at all. How much of that did you sort of take with you in the way you perform as a musician and a band leader?
I really pay so much attention to every single detail, little things he used to do, you know, and the most important thing I learned from him is love for music. He really loved music, and he had such a great time every time he got an opportunity to play and to perform for people or talk about music with you and sit down in the piano and try to put some chords and some things together. He enjoyed every second of it, you know. And that, I think, is the most important thing I took from him, you know, the passion and love for music.
Every day of my life, I think of you. And when I blow my horn, I think of you. If I could say how much you mean to me, I have no words to express my love for you. Your music plays inside my head.
Every day you think of him, and when you blow your horn, you think of him. It's been almost 20 years since Dizzy Gillespie died, Arturo.
Yeah.
And yet every day you think of
that
him.
That January 6, 93.
And every day, every day.
That's very true, because, you know, also it's funny because when I put them on my mouth and try to improvise or do something, I always look up, you know, and I say, this, what about that? And it's okay, or I should change that, or give me some hint, please.
Does he ever answer you?
Oh, yeah, my dreams and everything. Yeah, of course, man, yeah. Just listen to him and again and again and again.
As a child in Cuba, dreaming about what your life would become, could you ever have imagined that not only would you know your hero, but he would become your friend and you would become who you became?
That was probably only a dream, but not no more than a dream. I couldn't imagine anything because I grew up in the middle of the countryside of the island. I mean, in the middle of nowhere, you know. My family, nobody have nothing to do with the music at all. My father was a car mechanic and was a very, very, very extremely poor family. And I couldn't see the horizon in front of me at all. But, you know, it doesn't matter what you think or what you try. And I strongly believe in God, and I think God have plans for you.
Well, Arturo Sandoval, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
That's the jazz trumpeter Arturo Sandoval. His new record, a tribute to Dizzy Gillespie, is called Dear Diz. You can hear a few tracks at our website, nprmusic.org.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, here's Johnny.
50 years ago, Johnny Carson became the host of The Tonight Show, and during his 30 years as host, he reached a nightly audience of 15 million people. He became one of the most trusted and famous men in America. But Carson was intensely private off-screen, and very few people, including members of his own family, really knew him. Documentary filmmaker Peter Jones wanted to try and change that, and so once a year for 15 years, Jones sent Johnny Carson a letter begging him for permission to make a documentary on his life.
Dear Mr. Carson, my diary tells me it's been another year since my last attempt.
That's Peter Jones reading an excerpt from a letter dated January 10th, 2003. 8 weeks after that letter was sent, Jones finally received a phone call from the man himself.
And he said, Peter, I admire your persistence and your style, but I'm not going to do anything because I don't give a S-H fill in the blank.
Gotcha, right. He did not want to cooperate with your desire to make a documentary about his life.
I think he had deep regrets, especially about his personal life. He loved all the wives he was married to. There were four of them. And they genuinely loved him, too. But he had deep regrets that that, you know, did not work out because he had this problem with philandering. And also, he deeply regretted his relationship to his three sons, or frankly, lack of relationship with his three sons.
In the documentary, you talked to many, many people who worked with him, Doc Severinsen and his writers and people like Dick Cavett. And everyone, including, to some extent, one of his wives that you interviewed, his second wife, Joanne, they said, you never really knew Johnny. You never got to really know him.
I think there was Johnny Carson that America saw. And then there was John William Carson that he kept to himself. Johnny Carson, he was most content playing in the autumn leaves, you know, in Nebraska, or playing solitaire, or playing the drums. He was really, you know, content to just be with himself. Johnny Carson did not really exist anywhere else but in front of the camera. Privately, he was John William Carson.
Early on, a Time magazine reporter goes to Nebraska, interviews Johnny Carson's mom, watches the opening monologue with her, and she says that wasn't very funny. Jack Parr was edgier when he did the show. And that really hurt Johnny Carson.
And it is not insignificant to note this was a cover story article in 1967. Johnny Carson had been on the show for 5 years as the host. He was on top of the world, and for his mother to make that comment, it devastated him. And after he read that, he broke down and cried.
Peter, you interviewed many, many people who worked with Johnny Carson, writers and colleagues. You spoke to his second wife, Joanne, but you did not talk to any of his other wives or either of his surviving children. Why not?
I did talk off the record to two other wives, Joanna and Alex Carson. I did not talk to the boys. There was and remains a veil of secrecy surrounding Johnny Carson. They chose not to talk to me on the record because they felt they were honoring posthumously his wishes.
I'm speaking with documentary filmmaker Peter Jones. His new film is called Johnny Carson, King of Late Night. One of the things that he was able to do was to sort of be political and funny, but not partisan.
Tonight's monologue is dedicated to President Nixon. I've got a monologue that just won't quit.
He really went after Nixon during the Watergate period. He went after Bill Clinton, too. Some of it was with a wink and a nod.
Finally, some good political news. Bill Clinton has laryngitis, lost his voice.
And yet nobody knew what his politics were.
That is true. He struck a remarkable balance. He made fun of Democrats as well as Republicans. My hunch is that he would be a Democrat. But I know I can't, you know, confirm that. I know he was very close to the Reagans, to Ronald and Nancy Reagan, who admired him. She did not like the jokes.
World War III was just declared. I'm just kidding, of course, not really. I just wanted to get Reagan out of bed to watch the monologue.
She, as everyone knows, was very protective of her husband, and she would call and say, you know, that wasn't funny. But he nevertheless persisted because he was an equal opportunity offender.
He was somebody who made careers. I mean, he would bring comics on, and that was it. He gave you the thumbs up, and you were made. He did that for Jerry Seinfeld and Ray Romano and, of course, Joan Rivers, who became a very close friend and then betrayed him.
Joan Rivers broke Johnny's heart in a way I don't think even any of the failed marriages did, because this was someone he genuinely appreciated as a funny person, but also really liked.
No, my wedding night was a disaster. You know that. A lot of men smoke after they make love. Edgar smoked during. Now that's... Ask me for a light. You think that's nice? I say, get it yourself on the dashboard. What's the matter?
He felt so betrayed and brokenhearted when she called to tell him about her show well after he had found out about it.
Her show on Fox.
Her show on Fox.
And he had already found out about it through media leaks.
Yes, he found out about it, and when she called him, he hung up on her and famously never spoke to her again. And in the film, for the first time, she acknowledges, perhaps I should have called him sooner.
Peter, throughout his time on The Tonight Show, and even before when he, in his previous role as a game show host, he worked with Ed McMahon. He actually hired Ed McMahon. And they were very tight, these guys who got drinking. But somewhere around the middle of The Tonight Show's run, that ended. And there was quite a bit of tension between them, right?
There was tension always between Johnny and Ed on The Tonight Show because Johnny felt that Ed was intruding on him and his jokes at times.
My next guest doesn't really need an introduction, but my what?
Your first guest.
What did I say?
My next guest.
Well, he's my next guest.
Oh. It's also happens to be your first guest.
That's right. Yes. It's could be either one, first and next.
Yes. Which is it?
It's my first and next guest.
Ed would anticipate what Johnny was going to say and would sometimes say it. And that would upset Johnny tremendously. And there were a few occasions where the producer of The Tonight Show warned Ed that he could go if he didn't stop taking some of the laughs from Johnny.
But, of course, Johnny needed Ed. And, of course, Ed needed Johnny. I mean, that was part of the brand.
Absolutely. It was, as David Letterman says in the film, it was Laurel and Hardy. You can't have one without the other.
What was it that you learned while making this film that surprised you, that you didn't know about Johnny Carson?
What surprised me was, frankly, how little we could find about his interior life. I think we find as much as anybody has to date, but what was remarkable to me was still how protective he was of this impenetrable part of his persona. I hope we suggest clues, but I don't know if we really got it.
You people watching, I can only tell you that it has been an honor and a privilege to come into your homes all these years and entertain you. And I hope when I find something that I want to do and I think you will like and come back that you'll be as gracious inviting me into your home as you have been. I bid you a very heartfelt good night.
Johnny Carson's farewell 20 years ago this month. Peter Jones's documentary is called Johnny Carson, King of Late Night. It premieres tomorrow night on PBS stations across the country.
We're drinking, my friend, to the end of a sweet episode. Make it one for my baby and one more for the road.
For the week ending May 13th, 2012, that's the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. This week, our show was directed by Petra Mayer and Brent Bachman. Our production staff includes Phil Harrell, Walter Ray Watson, Lauren Silverman, Lily Percy, and Ali Dukakis. Mathoni Maturi is our senior editor, and Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. I'm Guy Raz. We're back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekend. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. It's on in most places between 5 and 6 p.m. on Saturdays and Sundays. And thanks for tuning in.
Let's make it one for my baby and one more.